so striking that the community embraced these findings so enthusiastically, considering that correlation does not establish cause. I mean, this is a fundamental precept of scientific study. And the correlation data, whether it's strong or it's not strong, still does not warrant this kind of confidence. And so it's intriguing to me how impassioned the ideological defense of this position is. The point I want to make in terms of science is that the ideology of molecular biology, which began with the acceptance of the Human Genome Project in the early 90s, was always suspect on the fact that Dick Lowington popularized this idea that the gene simply was reified to the point where it was thought it would serve as the fundamental substrate. And we know now that cannot be true. At the same time, much of this debate is going to be settled once we get enough genome sequence. There is an ongoing project to sequence 2,000 different people. And when it's said that the genome has been sequenced, one individual, we don't know what the variation is in human genomes. And this kind of data is so restrictive, so limited, and correlative, that it's really hard for a non-admission, myself, to understand why there's so much confidence in this study. So that's simply an observation. If you want to comment, fine.
My only comment is that I agree, and that's why the focus of my interest in the focus of my interest in investigation is on why did the community accept these claims, right, despite their badness, right?
Shelley?
First of all, it's a very clear and logically presented presentation. It's really delightful. It strikes me that the power of geneticization, the power of genetic reductionism is very strong. It's creating people's careers. It's creating these new venues of science. And what you found here is illustrative of a much broader effect. For example, in the past couple of years, scientific articles have claimed the social networking gene. Advertised, by the way, at the Harvard website. Those Harvard anthropologists were involved in it. Voting behavior gene published. This is all in scientific literature. A militant gene, most recently a liberal gene, marital fidelity gene in an international journal. So this is a broad movement that really gets down to intense reduction, genetic reductionism. Would you agree with that?
More work needs to be done on this, in the sense that when you speak to scientists, they absolutely distance themselves from genetic reductionism. Yet the field as a whole celebrates and places at the forefront those kinds of dramatic findings. Reductionism is definitely one of the issues here. If you take those claims, like the liberal gene, the militant gene, the fidelity gene, and so on, and then you imagine somebody taking that allele variant and looking at its variation among racial populations, think of the kinds of explosive claims that you would have. And that's really the move that I'm looking at. So while I would definitely advance a fundamental critique of behavioral genetics, right, I'm actually looking a little higher level at that kind of move that's going on as well.
Yeah. Enjoyed the presentation very, very much. But you must have spoken with Hardy's Sabetti over at Harvard, because she's in the selective, strong selection. She dismisses Lon's work. You're even in the 2009 little article that you cited about his commentary, when you look at the references he cites to support his work, two of the four papers are on diabetes, one is on hair morphology, and one is on stress. James Watson 2 years ago got fired because the scientific community doesn't believe this at all. So I think we're a little bit harsh on the scientific community, and I would say that, you know, you've got to let people like Lon work, because that's how science is done, and let him look all he wants. But the aspect of him finding anything more than fast selection and just very few alleles. Even in Scientific American in October, it showed that there's very slow selection on a gene that relates to hair, skin color. So we're not evolving that quickly. And the scientific community in general doesn't believe, I think, what he is suggesting at all.
Oh, yes. I think at this point, everyone distances themselves from Lon's 2005 claims. The point I was trying to make in the presentation, and perhaps I would need more time to establish it, is that the premises, the basic assumptions mobilizing the research, are actually uncontroversial. So he happens to be wrong in this case, and that's the reading of many of the scientists I speak with. We can talk more about the politics of his research in the community, but I completely agree with what you're saying. But we need to ask, why did this research get the initial credibility that it did, and why there's continuing research lines, for example, on FOXP2, in a very similar direction, and the confidence that it's not this one that was terrible, but the genes are coming.
The fact that the scientific community is critical has very little to do with the transmission of the message. That's all part of the much deeper ideology.
Is there a big spillover from this effort from gender in this race?
Well, I'll repeat the, it's very brief. She's asking whether there's a similar picture in the case of gender and genetics, or whether there's a spillover from gender to the race question. So my primary area of research is actually asking the same kinds of questions about emerging genomic research on sex and gender differences, which has been far less investigated and discussed than racial differences. And there are some similarities. It lags. The race research, but there are certainly similarities in the fixation and focus on finding sex differences in the genome, annotating the genome for gender, kind of tracing all that we know about sex differences in a genomic sense. And I'm definitely seeing neurogenetics claims about sex differences emerging from autism research in a similar model to this.
For sure.
I read it before, so obviously I knew what you were going to say. I really liked what you had to say, pointing it out in how this research was specifically different from lactase persistence. I was curious as to what sort of direction you thought that scientists should go in with respect to conducting objective research on race and IQ, and what that would amount to. I have an idea of what
So I'm definitely a Longinot toady on the objectivity question. So I mean something very specific by objectivity. I mean, what would be the conditions of critical discourse, the apparatus of dialogic exchange within the scientific community, that would give us any confidence that the community was rigorously investigating and questioning and inviting the kinds of criticality around claims around race and genetics and IQ, and that objectivity is a spectrum term or an achievement term. You get it to more or less extents depending on the credibility of the community. What happens with this transdisciplinarity is you have a splintering of what is the community? Right, and getting the folks in the room to have the transformative discussion, well, who would the folks be, right? So that's why we need to think about the epistemic dimensions of contemporary biosciences, right? So these old models of the scientific community should get together and set some standards around this don't apply when you've got these far-flung fields suddenly thrown together by a shared technological platform. So I would say I need to do more thinking about that, and we need to develop those models to apply to the contemporary biosciences.
Please feel free to use the microphone to ask your question. It can be hard to hear sometimes with people in the back.
Thank you.
stimulating the talk. It's a comment, and perhaps you can comment on it. I want to take up a point that Fred raised, the notion of correlations. Namely, you're presenting a model which various historical reasons to think of a single gene. What happens if we now start taking seriously the notion of interactions between genes and more complex things, but still try to give an account which is based upon these elementary entities which interact, etc.? You're already sensitive to it in terms of raising issues of gender, and what happens now is you have the power by virtue of computation to look at all sorts of correlations, etc., and give a more complex story.
Okay, so I'm going to get this number wrong, but for what you might consider the somewhat simple trait of height, there are 10 or 20,000 loci implicated. So there are thousands of loci implicated in height. So you take a behavioral trait and 10,000 genes express in the brain. So it's absolutely the consensus of behavioral geneticists that there will be, that we're moving to a multifactorial model. And there may be some genes that are major movers, but probably we're going to have whole swaths of genes that correlate imperfectly with certain kinds of behavioral tendencies or something like that. That's the kind of Plowman and Deary view. So as I said before, I think that more science studies work must be done to examine the what's going on with those kinds of claims. Are they less deterministic, right? There's a kind of distancing from determinism at the same time as moving audaciously forward with it. It does condition and change the way that we think about behavioral genetics and its implications. But despite those protestations that it's going to be many genes, we still see the elevation of certain particular genes as being hot genes to follow. And, you know, there are probably half a dozen genes implicated in things like depression, aggression, etc., that for the last decade or so, like MCPH and ASPM, have really, people are going hard at. So despite these protestations, there's a huge research trail, there's a well-carved path to move forward with other models as well.
Yes, sir.
I'm interested in your, I agree with your question, got to like try to work out why this stuff is happening, why this science, why it's so popular, whatever. But there's some things that seem to me to be baggage you might let go of. The first one you've already indicated, this idea that there is a community. I mean, it isn't just a matter of transdisciplinarity, it's a matter of even within something where people could peer review each other's papers, there's lots of different things that go into why they're excited about research. But the other thing, it seems to me a problem is your historical story that said it was all resolved with the bell curve debate. I mean, my sense is that there are lots of people, even if they backed off some of the claims, who felt like, the lefties were stuck on some old thing. Part of why I'm sensitized to this is that the behavioral geneticists still, when you listen to them, in their own settings where they don't know you're an outsider, they still trumpet this idea that the left or whatever used to believe that everything was environment. In the 60s, everything was environment. And they're clearly just stuck in the past. So they use this narrative. So you're using the narrative that we resolved it and the fringe held on to it. It was a fringe, and a lot of values to with that fringe, and I'm just dubious of that. The same way I'm dubious about the 60s don't seem to need to be an environmentally determinist age. There was, you know, Richard Lumpton was someone promoting genetic basis of intelligence in the 1960s. So there were many geneticists who were really trying to, well, in those days it was population genetics and protein polymorphism and stuff, who really thought we were going to get to understand things a whole lot better. And even in the sociological area, there was a lot of biological components going on. But yet, The narrative is very convenient, and the narrative is convenient for you to make your story. But I feel like if you really want to start to examine why people are asking these questions, you need to look more about continuities rather than this idea that there's some break going on now.
Oh, so to clarify, my argument was just that many people, I was trying to explain why people like perhaps many of us in this room who study race and biology and genetics have looked at all sorts of aspects in the development of post-genomic research on race and genetics, but have not looked as much at intelligence. And so my argument is that many people believe that the issue was resolved in the bell curve debates, and I'm trying to say, no, it wasn't. So I'm completely on board with you that many of the fundamental assumptions are still lurking around or unanswered for many people and continue to influence the research. And I mean, with respect to this historical argument about in the 60s we were all environment and today we're all genetic, I'd love to talk to you more about that. Even some folks among the behavioral geneticists, people like Deary and Plowman, are now arguing that we've turned too sharply towards the genetic and really perceiving, imprint, they suggest this.
Yeah. I want to talk first,
use a microphone.
I think I'm overanalyzing
people. Use a microphone.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to talk first about ideology a little bit, but you can then get to the science. But let me preface that by reminding you about Descartes, who had one of the smallest brain capacities on record. And whatever you think of Descartes' philosophy, I think nobody would use it with low IQ. So that's a good example to try it out.
Paul Sachs, another one.
Yeah, okay. Well, ideology. At last year's 50th anniversary meeting, I spoke about Marx's critique of naturalism and political economy and some of its modern implications, and I see now I could have added this example as well. Now, but by naturalism, I mean the attempt to, Marx's critique was the attempt to naturalize capitalism by showing that things have to be that way. And one can see now, according to that statement, the attempt to naturalize any existing social relationship is an issue. And this is, of course, an issue of struggle, and as you point out, this is never going to be resolved as long as we have social struggles going on. But I think there's even a deeper level, and this is where I think we get to the science. What was Marx's critique of Mill? That Mill said, production is subject to natural laws, we can't change that. Distribution is subject to social laws, and that's what we can change. And Marx says, but look, production and distribution are just two sides of the same process, you can't separate them. They're aspects of one process. And I think the same issue comes up here. Nature versus nurture, let's say. Nature, let's say, corresponds to genes, nurture corresponds to environment. And when you spoke about the critique of the past that there was a failure to disambiguate genetic and environmental factors, I think once you use the factor language, you have already given up the game. They are not factors. The nature and nurture, genes and environment are two sides of the same process, and we have to understand them that way. And there's a book whose author, the author of it, I forgot, Not Now Genes, the book, which has a wonderful critique of this division and gives you a way forward to how to proceed in research in a way that overcomes it overcomes, goes beyond this division, shows you how to proceed with research. And I think that's the kind of approach that should be pursued in